evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, March 21st, 2019. South Sudanese activist Peter Bier Ajak and businessman Carbino Wall make their first appearance in court today.
The charges that are given to us in verbally, they are charged under Section 48, Section 67, Section 69, Section 72 and 78 of the Penal Code.
And a South Sudanese minister denies allegation of corruption.
I wish you could show me the contract that we signed. And to make it clear to the public, the chairman of the MPTC, in his consultation with the leadership of the Republic of South Sudan, were looking for ways and means by which they could easily and quickly provide support for implementation of the peace agreement.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan government arranged a court appearance today for activists Peter Bier Ajak, businessman Carbino Wall, and four other individuals 1 year after they were arrested and detained at Juba's National Security Service headquarters. More than 100 people, including civil society activists, representatives of the international community, and family members, attended the court hearing in a small room at Juba High Court. The seven suspects were driven to court under tight security. Some appeared to be exhausted. The seven sat side by side and followed the proceedings quietly as the prosecution and defense lawyers presented their argument. The five defense lawyers were present at today's hearing. Monluak Alor Kwal, who represents peace activist Peter Bier Ajak, says the six individuals arraigned in court today are people accused of taking part in last October's incident at Juba's National Security Service headquarters, in which prisoners broke into the weapons store and held two prison guards hostage. Speaking to reporters after the hearing, Kwal said the six were demanding the government to provide the prisoners with due process.
Bier appeared in the court today, but he's not appearing for the initial arrest that he was detained for. Okay. He is appearing here for an incident that happened while he was in detention. The incident, I think there was some uprising of the detainees.
Where?
In October.
Where?
In October, in the National Security Facility, detention facility. Okay, and Bier happened to be there. He was in the detention already. Okay, now, yeah, that is the incident that they brought to court. They investigated the incident and brought it to court. But he was not investigated or charged for the initial arrest.
Kwal says Bier was arrested in July 2018 and never charged with a crime in connection with that arrest. He says rather than charge the suspects for the October 2018 incident at the Blue House, the state should have charged the suspects with a crime in connection with their initial arrest.
We protested and we said that his detention has gone on for too long and he is in a military facility. Mm-hmm. He should be transferred to the prison. Well, the court said it is too early for them to consider this application because they have not listened to the prosecution. When they listen to the prosecution, they know what are the charges. In the process, we can renew our application. But they have granted, of course, our application for Bier to have a translator because that was the application. He wanted a translator.
Another lawyer, Ajak Mayol, charges the government repeatedly denied him access to his clients at the National Security Service detention facility. He says he appealed to the High Court to grant bail to his clients, transfer them to a government facility, and provide them with medical care.
We were seated with most of the officers in our meeting with them, and that's what we were asking, that at least we will be given unhindered access. That has been granted, and we will have unhindered access. They're still in the National Security Detention Facilities. We are denied bail and the transfer to the South Sudan Prison Service.
Mayol says he doubts if the issues raised by the prosecutors regarding the October uprising were ever presented to the court, but says the defense lawyers will have to wait for the trial. He says the defendants could face death penalty on one charge.
The charges that are given to us in verbally, They are charged under Section 48, Section 67, Section 69, Section 72 and 78 of the Penal Code, and then Section 57 of the National Security Act. Well, there are multiple, and it all encompasses on the charges on terror and sabotage and all the other crime against the state.
One of the defendants refused legal representation. Judge Sumaya Saleh, who presided over today's hearing, adjourned the hearing until Monday of next week. The Washington-based Enough Project's investigative initiative is out with a new report detailing the role of corruption and financial mismanagement in South Sudan amid the peace process, and according to the report, it is widespread. The Centrist Safeguards to Peace report says among the issues are weak institutions, economic underdevelopment, and an absence of justice for corrupt officials. Mark Folio, the Centrist investigative analyst, says featuring out to curb corruption across South Sudan could be a top priority.
A key part of it is making corruption or anti-corruption reforms front and center within the peace agreement itself at this point, because there is this chapter of the peace agreement that's not talked about very often, but chapter 4 is about the financial management of the country. And so, for example, one of the recommendations we make is that the AU could appoint an envoy completely focused on Chapter 4 to be able to fit into the peace agreement and keep the keep press focused on it, keep the parties themselves aware of what are those steps that you need to take.
And you're referring to just for the listeners who haven't read the report, mm-hmm. You're referring to the AU Transparency Envoy.
Right, and this isn't an envoy that has been used elsewhere, but noticing from one of the trappings that other post-conflict scenarios have had is that the corruption reforms, they're embedded in peace agreements, but they sort of take a backseat to the political or security arrangements. And part of the way the recommendation here is saying to remedy that, the AU could put forward someone who's fully focused on anti-corruption issues.
Now, the report also introduces an idea of an independent national audit. Now, this sounds really good on paper, but what would that look like on the ground if this idea, you know, does catch on?
Yeah, there's the idea of using a national audit has been used in a number of other countries for certain sectors. And the idea here would be a third-party audit, so an accounting firm from outside the country to come in, look at the books. And this is something I think for some time, the disparate way in which the economy is working, in which the government is taking procurement contracts or concessions of mining, for example, and be able to lay out sort of what the foundation is in which to build. Because without knowing where the economy or where the budget is at this point, it's really hard to move forward the overwhelming need for an economy that's actually be able to fund the peace in the long term and kind of set for on a path to success.
I noticed in the report, one of the 6 points that you spoke about just a little bit ago is that, South Sudan has weak government institutions that fail to provide basic services. That's a line from the report. But, you know, the government or a government supporter might say, well, South Sudan is a very young nation, less than 10 years old. What would be your reaction to people who push back a little bit on that point?
Right. It's perfectly reasonable to have sort of institutions that aren't all completely built up at this point. And I think the important point for it to fit into the peace agreement is that continuing to rely on insufficient institutions is just not providing the confidence that international donors are looking for in certain institutions, or what private investors would want as well within sort of that economic governance framework. And so, there's an opportunity here to provide a little bit more support to certain institutions. I'll say the central bank, for example. The central bank is so key to the economy, and getting it to run in a manner which is more transparent and more equitable for those who rely on the central bank for foreign exchange, for example, needs to be sort of more central to the conversation about what is needed in terms of the implementing a peace agreement that can sustain peace for the long term.
That was Mark Farulo, the Centrist investigative analyst, speaking to Ayen Dengbior from Washington. South Sudan Cabinet Affairs Minister Martin Elia Lomuro reacted angrily to recent accusations by the deputy chairman of the National Pre-Transitional Committee, who said the committee was wasting money. Last week, Henry Oduor told this program that he saw copies of letters signed by the NPTC chairman, Tut Galwak, authorizing the NPTC secretary to send millions of dollars on new vehicles and food. Lomuro denies the accusations. Onen Walter Solomon reports for VOA from Juba.
NPTC co-chair Henry Oduor says he spoke with President Salva Kiir, who promised to investigate. He says he also told NPTC chairman Galwak the letter for renovating houses implies that the commission is squandering money that would have been put to good use. During an exclusive interview with South Sudan in Focus on Wednesday, Cabinet Affairs Minister Lomuro, who is also the NPTC secretary, flatly denies the accusations.
I wish you could show me the contract that we signed. And to make it clear to the public, the chairman of the NPTC, in his consultation with the leadership of the Republic of South Sudan, were looking for ways and means by which they could easily and quickly provide support for implementation of the peace agreement. In their contacts, some individuals, managers of some companies, offered to provide us the support necessary, whether it is in form of food materials or other materials and vehicles.
Lomuro admits Galwak instructed him to prepare contracts for cows and sorghum, but says he did not act on those orders.
The chairman would direct the secretary, who prepared these documents, to go to the other members in the NPTC council. It has not reached that stage. It was dealt with and stored right from me, because it is me who prepared the agenda. And I did not feel that those documents constituted procedures that were credible.
Lomuro says that the companies that previously approached NPTC with offers for logistics and food withdrew the offers. He says NPTC officials agreed to work as a team to overcome the challenges facing implementation of the peace agreement.
It's sad that Henry Oduor, who represents IO in the NPTC, engages in radio propaganda contrary to the principles of the NPTC, which states clearly that the NPTC in its function is impartial and will operate as one team. That means whether you're from the incumbent Tigonu, you're from the IO, or any of the other components of the agreement.
Also, Article 1, Section 4, Subsection 8 of the Revitalized Peace Agreement states that a fund shall be established from government funds and contributions of donors for implementing the activities of the pre-transitional period. Lomuro says the NPTC received copies of the agreement from IGAD 1 month after the deal was signed, which delayed the preparation of its budget. He pointed out that the government deposited 100 million South Sudanese pounds and $10 million into the NPTC account to implement the deal.
We're not hearing anybody telling us that, oh, this is the help we have for you. We don't want to hear criticism of delays. These delays will be corrected. I know those who are playing on delays, they want the agreement to fail, but this agreement will not fail.
Lomuro says that the South Sudanese people have suffered enough, and while politicians have caused a lot of shame on the country, it's time to stop bickering and move forward with implementing the peace deal. For VOA News, I am Onen Walter Solomon in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at the Rwandan Penal Court. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's the most important value that your parents taught you?
They taught me to respect everyone. This makes me to live well with any person.
How to live together with people and how to
to prepare myself for the future. For example, I was taught how to cook by my grandmother. So I stayed with my grandmother and he taught me how to cook. So it has helped me because I don't always stay with my family. So that's the most important value my parents have taught me.
Being someone who might be honest in my life, even in our daily life, it's very important anyway, because in these days many people may not be honest because of their interests.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Rwanda's Supreme Justice have begun deliberating a challenge to the country's new penal code. An independent lawyer, Richard Mugisha of Trust Law Chambers, has filed a petition challenging some of the court's provisions, including one that bans cartoons that humiliate public officials and another that makes adultery a criminal offense. Eugene Uimana has more from Kigali.
Defending this petition before the Supreme Court, lawyer Richard Mugisha said the articles he highlighted contravene the letter and the spirit of the Rwandan Constitution.
The penal code criminalizes adultery. It criminalizes desertion of the matrimonial home. Criminalizing those provisions is inconsistent with the Constitution, because the Constitution does provide for the protection of the family. And criminalizing these offenses with the possibility that there will be imprisonment, issues which are domestic in nature, should be left to the parties to take responsibility to resolve them. The other one is there were a number of provisions which talked about humiliating public officials of a certain category. No, I just said that they are inconsistent with Article 38 of the Constitution, which guarantees freedom of the press and freedom of expression.
This case has drawn the attention of rights activists and other observers, as Rwandans are not used to see anyone challenge even a ministerial order. Prof. Mutwesi Hamwe, a women's group, the Rwandan Association of Journalists, and the University of Rwanda have filed amicus curiae or friends of court petitions to take part in the case. Profam opposes Mugisha's effort to decriminalize adultery, saying it would increase homicide and domestic violence. Judith Kanakuze is the group's president. She says that if adultery is not a crime, things will get worse in the society. Her organization often finds that women get killed over finding out what their husbands do, and homicide is growing. But the other amicus curiae fires back Mugisha. Etienne Ruvewana is a lecturer in the School of Law at the University of Rwanda.
In the University of Rwanda, we have a component in our responsibilities which is called the service to the community. We thought that we could give our contribution to elucidate some of the principles that we think the court could refer to. So we wanted to help the court. The way these provisions are written, they are very much susceptible of violating some of the freedoms, like what I mentioned in the court, like the principle of equality, the freedom of expression, the principle of legality.
The government's attorney told the justice all articles in the code are there to maintain order and protect senior officials who are vulnerable due to their responsibilities. However, the Minister of Justice, Johnston Businge, salutes the petitioners.
It means a number of things. One, it means constitutionalism. We have a constitution which allows anybody who thinks that a law is unconstitutional to go to court and take the government to court. Number two, I see rule of law. Number three, I see diversity. We understand the law differently. Therefore, we have the institution of the Supreme Court, which will pass a decision, then we will abide by that decision.
The new penal law came into force last August, replacing a code that had been in use more than 40 years. Under the new code, any married person found guilty of adultery risks a jail sentence of up to 1 year. The same law provides for sentences of up to 2 years and hefty fine for anyone who publishes, writings, or cartoons that humiliate public officials. The same law prescribes a 7-year sentence and a fine of 7 million Rwandan francs for defaming the head of state. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
From Kigali, we come back to South Sudan. Jonglei State authorities have decided to suspend all river transport between Bor and Fangak State due to insecurity. The move follows deadly clashes between the Juang and Chui communities of Eastern Lake and Jonglei State over fishing rights on the Nile. At least 2 people were killed and 5 others wounded during clashes between the 2 communities. Deng Gai Deng has more for VOA from Bor.
Following Tuesday clashes in Eastern Lakes and Jonglei States, Jonglei Governor Pili Vagwir is advising all traders and travelers who normally use the River Nile to travel from one place to another between villages in the area to find other means of transportation until state authorities put in place proper security measures in the area.
Those traders, I think they should wait and see, because we don't have means of communication. We don't know what is happening in Jorawaj. We don't know what is happening in Chotakwet. And we are using information from those who are either paddling or those who are walking to where there is network. There is network in Malek. There is network in places like Paliaw and Mar. These are the people we try to contact and to know what is happening. But otherwise, those traders who are using the river transport, they should try to get information before they move anywhere.
Aguirre condemned Tuesday clashes and said he was saddened by the events.
There are a number of people that have been killed in this river, and there are a number of wounded. We don't know their numbers. It's because the arms are in the hands of people who are not eligible to hold arms. And it goes with the arms that have been spread all over South Sudan, and anybody can commit a crime.
Aguirre says his officers requested that the national government deploy a military force to patrol the area.
We have requested a force that can be patrolling this area that has a problem, so that people moving from Fangak, people moving from Shambe, people moving from Jonglei area should be able to move freely along the river.
Eastern Lakes Information Minister Taban Abel says ownership of the island is still being contested between the 2 communities.
One person was killed from this side, and no injuries were reported. And on the side of the attackers who came from that area, one person was killed and 5 injuries were reported. On the 19th of March again, these people mobilized and they attacked the area again.
Mm-hmm.
So the commissioner had to rein in his people and told them to vacate the area. So they vacated the Liadboy area and came back to Malek. So yesterday evening, the area was occupied by the members of the community called a Juang community of Jonglei State.
Abel is calling on the 2 communities to stay calm and allow state government authorities to settle the dispute over fighting rights in the area. Speaking in Dinka, Elijah Thongobor, the Secretary General of the Boat Trade Union in Bor, says all traders with motor boats that are suspended from traveling the River Nile and were en route to Pangak State are now stranded at Bor River Port along with all of their goods.
Seen yesterday up to today, there are no motorboats moving along the Nile, and this has really affected the business. All the boats that are already loaded with food items, including boat hired by WFP, are stranded here.
Thongobor is urging Eastern Lakes and Jonglei State authorities to act as soon as possible so that travelers and traders can once again resume transportation on the Nile. The Nile is the largest river in the world. 60% of more than 6,600 kilometers runs through Sudan and South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Deng Gai Deng, reporting from Bor.
As Uganda's population increases, many young people are finding it difficult to find jobs that pay well. A government directive to introduce the teaching of Mandarin Chinese in schools may offer a better employment opportunities. Halima Athumani reports for VOA from the town of Luero.
In Uganda, Mandarin Chinese is called the language of the future. And here, at Everest College in Luero District, secondary students recite a poem about treasuring life. China is a major trade partner and investor in Africa, and many countries are encouraging their citizens to learn the language. Last year, Uganda's Ministry of Education named 35 schools countrywide where the Chinese language would be taught. The decision was driven by the ties between the countries, says Grace Waguma, director of the National Curriculum Development Center.
There is a lot of economic activities, infrastructure development, medical, name it, that China is working with Uganda. And many of our people, the Ugandans, are trading with China. So China has become a country that we need to get to know and get into it. And the only way we can do it is also through the languages.
Chinene Charles is one of the students learning Mandarin at Everest. He thinks the language will open up job opportunities.
I'm interested in learning Chinese because it can help me to be employed in Chinese companies. And if I have a friend who knows Chinese, can get a job and invite me to act as an interpreter in Chinese anniversaries.
For the last 4 years, the Confucius Institute at Makerere University has been instructing students in Chinese. The students are now being assigned to different schools in the country to teach the language. Namisi Moses Apollo says that he was a poor student in his regular schooling and he worried about finding employment. But he says that for him, learning Chinese was easy and upon graduation, he was immediately asked to start teaching in a pilot class in Luero. According to Namisi, there are vast opportunities in Uganda for people who can teach Chinese, though he notes that in most cases, it's the Chinese government paying the salaries and one has to be very professional.
The market is vast, open, but you also have to be, I would say, a titan at negotiations to get the best out of it. You need to give it your best. You need to play your ass at last. That is how you can be able to get the job. So you have to be not only good at Chinese language, but also at the culture and the communication skills.
Lao Da Tu Shang Fei. Yes, I remember those kids you used to sing.
Visiting Chinese officials have over the years emphasized what they call the template of Africa-China cooperation. China has funded many large infrastructure projects in Uganda, including the 600-megawatt Karuma hydropower project with a price tag of $1.8 billion, and a highway between Kampala and Entebbe, which cost $350 million. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Luero, Uganda.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Wasaka by JJD Muzika. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Fumbe ibe raba ya bagwes kasolo apasaka aframal wasaka bebe kunne dif asani nina der bakana bebet Mal Hamam Abu Hakulu Deresu Ben Bikul Giafa Uma Hakulu Deresu Bana Sukran Mama Kamala Mama Diki Asaneta Kumrabana Kwesi